As the world begins to open up in some corners, there is still a lot of uncertainty for business owners on what the days and months ahead will look like. And that's particularly so for those in retail and hospitality, who are operating under restrictions today, if they've even been allowed to reopen. And for those still awaiting a return to work, there is hope that loyal customers and those missing simple pleasures, like going out for a coffee or a drink, will return in great numbers when the doors do swing open again. But one thing is clear. Physical distancing in cafes and restaurants just won't work in the long run, especially in busy cities where businesses are making very thin margins at the best of times. The hospitality sector has been one of the hardest hit during this pandemic, but it's also one used to a lot of hard work and doing what it takes to stay viable. You're listening to The Entrepreneurs with me, Daniel Bache. Today, I check in with David Abramovich, the CEO and founder of Grind, the group behind 11 central London cafes and eateries, to hear why David is staying very optimistic about the future. And a little later in the show, we'll get some advice on building robust businesses for the long term. I check in with Alex Lazaro, the Silicon Valley venture capitalist, teacher, and author of the new book, Out Innovate. Alex writes about why founders need to scrap the growth at all costs unicorn model and start thinking more about the camel, being built for the long haul. As we've been saying in recent weeks, there is no perfect time to start a business. And so Alex also takes some questions on where to look for opportunities. But first up, Grind. David Abramovich opened his first location, Shoreditch Grind, on Old Street back in 2011. More recently, the company has been one of the capital's fastest-growing hospitality companies, has opened its own roastery, and had big plans for 2020. And ahead of this pandemic, the company spent what it would have cost to fit out its next location on shoring up its online and direct-to-consumer business. It's a decision that has paid off, especially in this time, as many loyal customers stuck at home have been able to order their favorite beans or a tin of compostable coffee pods. Here's my conversation now with David, where we start by talking about the early days of the pandemic.
We started in 2011, and it's taken us, you know, the best part of 10 years to get to the point where we have 11 locations on the high street and a coffee roasting facility and a head office and, you know, employed 300 staff. And it took 10 years to build and about 10 days to close it down, which was pretty crazy, really. You know, we started to see sales drop off dramatically in kind of the lead up to the lockdown, as you know, has been reported by most people. You know, it started off suddenly with 10% down, 20% down where we should be. And then all of a sudden that became, you know, 50%, 60%. Once Boris went on TV on the Monday of that week and said, you know, you should try and avoid restaurants if you can, or it gave some very kind of ambiguous advice and didn't actually close restaurants, but basically told people not to go, which wasn't entirely helpful. So off the back of that, we made the decision to close almost everywhere the next day. We kept three open. That's three of our kind of neighborhood stores, which is where people live rather than where people work. So, you know, Shoreditch, Greenwich and Exmouth Market, and we kept them open just for takeaway. And basically, you know, we just consolidated as much perishable stock into those three sites as we could, you know, juices, avocados, that kind of bread that was going to go off, and just, you know, tried staying open for the rest of that week, which was, you know, limited in its success. It was okay. It was probably around break even. At least we didn't throw a lot of stuff in the bin. And then on the Friday at 5 p.m, obviously the famous lockdown announcement came on, and you know, off the back of that, we immediately took the decision to, you know, protect the staff first and foremost, and closed the sites immediately from that point, and they've remained closed since. So I think that's about 8 weeks now they've been closed.
You know, you talk about essential workers in an economy, in a society, but you often forget how important the people are that serve you a glass of wine or serve you your coffee on the way to work in the morning. You know, we have incredible contact with these people. And as you say, a lot of your locations are where people work and where they live. So, you know, they'll be excited that you're supporting them, and hopefully you'll be able to reopen again soon. But I guess in this time, we do realize that how important service staff and baristas are to our way of life.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think one of the good things that's coming out of this is, you know, maybe for a while at least, we've stopped celebrating people from Love Island, and you know, and we've started celebrating people who matter a little bit more, you know, like obviously the NHS, but even, you know, I think we're all suddenly looking at the people in the supermarket that we go to through a slightly different light and going, do you know what, these people have been here through this whole thing, stacking shelves and helping to keep the food system going. And I think, you know, you see posters everywhere of, you know, thanks to the lorry drivers and the van drivers and the NHS workers. And, you know, I think that's great. I think that's one of the few positives to come out of this, is that actually there's a lot of people, and hospitality workers included, who get up really, really early in the morning and work really hard, really long hours, not always for amazing pay, to keep, you know, to keep society turning over. So yeah, I think it's really important that we recognize that.
You know, as we say, hopefully it will be a case where people are able to get back into your locations very soon in London. Can you talk to me a little bit about that?
Look, I think going back is something that we can't wait to do. But at the same time, it has to be done kind of at the right time and in the right way. And especially for central London businesses, you know, our sites are in London Bridge, in Liverpool Street, in Soho. These places are ghost towns at the moment. Like, there is no one there. And even though, you know, you pop out to your local kind of more villagey areas and there's people around, the central London and the places where the office buildings are still absolute ghost towns. So I think it's really important that the media and the press and government realise that, you know, just because that people see photos of busy local high streets, you know, places in the middle of cities are still deserted, and restaurants, news agents, off licenses, coffee shops, dry cleaners, key cutting places, you know, there's a whole economy of shops are built around serving the people in offices. And until those people are going back to the offices en masse, all of those industries are going to need government support and rent support if we want those things to be there when people do go back to the offices. And I think that's kind of being overlooked a little bit. You know, you read things in the paper like, oh, maybe the solution is to open up as market stalls on the street. And it's like, all of this stuff is a bit of a plaster, to be honest, a plaster on a major injury. And it's just, you know, it's just shuffling deck chairs, to be honest. You know, I think this is going to affect major cities much, much more, because people are just not going to be taking transport into those cities.
Well, at this point, how seriously is the conversation with the company about what the lasting impact will be? Obviously, there's the short term in wanting to know when you can open and in what capacity. But long term, you know, big companies are talking about having people permanently work from home, or, you know, have let their lease lapse and won't be coming back to the office. So, I mean, there will be an impact no matter what.
Yeah, for sure. Look, and I think that's an issue. Look, I think, you know, our locations were all very busy and very successful before this lockdown. But, you know, no matter where you are on the spectrum, I think if the number of people commuting and travelling to offices drops substantially, then that's going to have an impact on everything from commercial property prices to residential property prices to all that stuff. I personally think it's a bit overblown. I think we'll look back in 2 years and go, do you remember all that chat about closing offices? You know, people are still in the office. People are still doing that. I think people might want a little bit more flexibility, that more people might choose to do 4 days a week and one day or something like that. But I think the kind of the end of the office is a little bit of a moment in time, as opposed to a permanent thing. I think it's something for people to write about and focus on at the moment. I think everyone forgets that we've had the most amazing weather during this lockdown, and everyone's got this kind of utopian, they're going to sit in their garden in the sun forever. And that's just not reality.
Yeah, I think it's in this period, in this sort of pause we've been put into, in not having to go to the office, people will realize how much it is great to get out of their house and not have to homeschool their kids and, you know, be stuck inside. So I agree with you. We will be going back to that. What that looks like, we'll find out in the days and weeks and months ahead. But on that vein, you know, people are also really doubly, I think, more interested in their local businesses and who they support. And, you know, those people I talked about earlier, those people you come across in your daily life, the people you buy a loaf of bread from or a cup of coffee from on the way to the office. And, you know, to get into the actual online part, it's interesting that people are now able to still engage with you and support you to find out what you're doing in this time. Do you think that'll be an important part of the business going forward as well, this case of people being able to order more? I know it's a focus for the business for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think I've been seeing it as important for some time now. So, you know, we did a substantial crowdfunding raise about 18 months ago, and I decided basically to invest one site's worth of money, which is, you know, a seven-figure sum, into online instead of into another physical high street location. So that meant relocating our roastery to a much larger one in Elephant and Castle. That meant developing our own compostable Nespresso pods. That meant a new Shopify-powered website, adding to the digital team, outsourcing fulfillment to a third-party fulfillment company, and you know, lots of stuff, you know, bespoke packaging, buying more equipment, you know, a serious project to start building Grind at Home, which is what we called it, and to start trying to grow that as a part of the business, to diversify slightly away from being so reliant on the high street, which we were, you know, at that stage we were 100% reliant on the high street, really. So yeah, look, I think obviously very grateful now that we did that, because I mean the online side of our business has been completely transformed by this. And you know, I had a kind of a 3-year plan, and we're now on about year 5, and we're kind of 8 weeks into lockdown. I mean, it's been, you know, when we went into this, our turnover, direct to consumer, represented a low single digit percentage of our group turnover. I think even if all of our sites were open and coronavirus hadn't happened and we were still trading at those levels, if you now bolted on our direct business, we would grow turnover by about 50%. So it's substantial, you know, many millions of run rate turnover direct to consumers. So that has transformed the business, and for sure I see that as something that I hope will keep on going. And it's been amazing how many of our existing customers have chosen to support us by buying online, which has been really great. And also, you know, we're reaching lots of new customers outside London and across the world as well, which is amazing.
That's an interesting opportunity almost, in that people are able to, as you say, support the businesses they like, but they can feel a little bit of normalcy perhaps if they can get their coffee from Grind, you know, the place they're used to. They can make that at home now. That, as I say, is an interesting opportunity perhaps for you moving forward to grow on the brand. What do you think of that?
Yeah, no, for sure. Look, I think there's we're playing into a few things, really. I think, you know, people still want to have the ultra high quality kind of flat white experience at home. I certainly do. You know, we're seeing this now as an opportunity to build a really significant at home business. Just before lockdown, we went live with Soho House Group. So we supply all of the coffee to their members clubs and hotels, and we supply our compostable Nespresso pods for their hotel rooms as well. So we're now going to be growing that with them across the world, and we're looking to kind of piggyback into the key cities that they're in and try and, you know, start acquiring Grind at Home customers around the world as well, using them as a bit of a springboard into each kind of local key city around the world. So, you know, I think the opportunity is massive, and the amazing thing about online is it can just scale so much faster and so much more seamlessly than a bricks and mortar business that requires, you know, leases and fit outs and local staff, etc. So yeah, it's really, really exciting.
As we look forward and try to imagine what it will be like to go back to the coffee shop or to go back out for lunch and dinner and these things, and there is talk about social distancing in restaurants, I just wonder what your take is on that and what it would take to reopen. Would you want to be involved in that if you can only have, you know, 20% of the restaurant full or something like that? Give me a sense of what the conversations are like at Grind over that.
I'm pretty optimistic about everything always, but this is one of those things where I am very pessimistic about it. Like, I think people need to get real on this. Like, restaurants under social distancing do not work. Like, end of story. Like most restaurants are, you know, barely profitable as it is, like your average restaurant on the high street. These are tough businesses, and business rates, London living wage, you know, the price of everything has gone up because of the pound dollar since Brexit. You know, these things have been under intense pressure for the last few years anyway. And, you know, no one's profit margins have improved over the last few years. No one's. So these are challenging businesses anyway. Like, most of them can't survive a 20% drop in turnover compared to where they were, unless there are substantial changes to the system. Obviously, business rates have been suspended now for a year, which is helpful. But unless there's a major change to the rent system, you know, any thoughts of 25% or even 50% capacity being commercially viable are just nonsense. Like, and I think so many places in central London and other key cities, you know, rent is high, so tables are packed together, and you want to maximize the covers during your busy times. You know, in our biggest site, Greenwich, we'll do 400-500 people for brunch in a few hours. That is what, it's those few hours of intense trade, be it on a Friday night or whenever it might be, that fund the overall operation. And if you're really limited during those times, these businesses are just not going to be commercially viable. And, you know, trying to have people 2 meters apart in central London, it's just impossible. It just doesn't work.
David, just lastly, I know I've taken a good deal of your time, and I do appreciate that. But, you know, you say you are an optimist, so I wonder what you are finding positive in these days and what you're looking forward in the days and weeks ahead with your team, which sounds like a very strong one at that.
Yeah, look, I'm hoping that we can get back to relative normality as soon as possible. And I think really that has to be the way out of this. So I think, you know, I think the rest of 2020 is about survival, and it's just about us all, you know, from the high street perspective, just, you know, landlords, tenants, the government having sensible conversations and doing sensible deals about just how do we stay alive and keep people employed for the rest of this year. And hopefully, you know, at some point late this year or early next year, we can get back to operating without people needing to be 2 meters apart. I think really that's the only solution to this, because otherwise the pub and the restaurant as we know it are effectively dead. You know, and there will be some very large spaces where plastic screens can be installed to keep people apart, but that's not really a solution across the whole economy. So look, I'm taking the view, we're focusing as much as we can on the pieces of the business that are working. So, you know, Soho House starting to open up around the world and some of our other wholesale customers, so we're supplying them. And then obviously we're pushing direct as hard as we can. And then we'll probably get a couple of our stores open for takeaway only in the next few weeks. And then in terms of the bigger restaurants, we'll see how it goes. We'll see how guidelines evolve. You know, this thing moves so fast against us. I'm hoping that there could be, you know, some more positive movements quite quickly to relax things a bit more, if possible. So we're taking the view that we'll kind of react as legislation changes, rather than starting to tear out our sites and build plastic screens and do all of this stuff for a world that we just don't really know what it looks like yet. But yeah, we will be okay.
That's the good news. Very happy to hear that. David, thank you so much for your time. This has been fascinating.
Pleasure. Good to chat.
David Abramovich, founder and CEO of Grind. Next up, this week's expert guest. Alex Lazaro is a writer, venture capitalist, and teacher of global entrepreneurship. His new book is called Out Innovate: How Global Entrepreneurs from Delhi to Detroit Are Rewriting the Rules of Silicon Valley. In the book, Alex writes about a shift towards interest in camels over unicorns. Where the growth-at-all-costs flashy model of building a business grabs the headlines, surviving for the long run is a much better investment for the economy, our planet, and our communities. As you know, we at Monocle are much more interested in companies and brands built to last. And in light of this global pandemic, the importance of building robust companies has been underscored. Here now is my conversation with Alex.
By day, I'm a venture capitalist, not an author. I work for a global fund called Cathay Innovation, which invests across Asia, Europe, North America, and Africa. Before this, I was at Omidyar Network, which is the venture capital firm, philanthropy, and impact fund of Pierre and Pam Omidyar. Pierre's the founder of eBay. And so I've always had one foot in Silicon Valley and one foot investing in startups around the world. And outside of work, I teach entrepreneurship at the Middlebury Institute for International Studies, which is Middlebury College's graduate program in Monterey. And I've been getting really frustrated that I kept assigning, you know, for instance, on the teaching side, my students books on innovation best practice. But everything I shared was invariably rooted in a time and a place, Silicon Valley and today, and for a very particular type of asset-light, software-based startup that wants to grow extraordinarily fast. And I always felt like I had to contextualize it to the reality of building startups in ecosystems around the world. My students were, you know, I'm from Winnipeg. They were moving back to places like that, back to the Midwest, or moving to emerging markets to build kind of a high impact social enterprise or something like that. They were just operating in different contexts. And I believe that the best entrepreneurs operating in places like Detroit or Chicago or Winnipeg or Amsterdam or Bangalore or Nairobi have more in common with the best entrepreneurs in Sao Paulo than they do with those in San Francisco. And yet no one is telling their stories. And so that was the genesis of the book. I decided I would. I interviewed about 200 folks, about 55, 60 entrepreneurs made it into the book as case studies. And I think that taken together, if you look at the most successful entrepreneurs, you know, in my case, it's you know, companies that are a couple hundred million to a couple billion dollars, you know, growing fast or have scaled already or that kind of thing. I think that taken together, those best entrepreneurs are not only challenging some of Silicon Valley's conventional wisdoms, increasingly they're reinventing startup best practice in some meaningful ways. And obviously, I think there's a lot these entrepreneurs can learn from each other, but as the context has also changed in the Valley too. And, you know, the whole world has shifted to an ecosystem of less capital, less resources, more constraints, more macroeconomic shocks in the age of Corona. And so I actually think that the role models on how to survive and scale and succeed don't come from the Valley anymore. They will come from the entrepreneurs that have succeeded and been in those contexts all along. And so in many ways, I think the book is more germane today than ever.
Well, that's interesting. And I really want to jump into that and how our world is going to move forward in business best practice, obviously, with a lot less resources, as you set out. Just to go back and talk about sort of the idea of the Silicon Valley startup versus other places in the world, emerging markets, as you say, there is this obsession with the idea of the fast growth unicorn, right? Build it quickly, pump a lot of VC funding into it and you know, hope for the best. But in reality, it doesn't really work that way. And you started to talk about the shift sort of in Silicon Valley, how it's not working that way right now. But just talk to us a little bit about those differences that you were trying to explain.
Yeah. And so the unicorn is both a numerical value, but it's also a philosophy on how to build startups. And that's the philosophy. The method is growth at all costs. It's okay to subsidize user acquisition in service of growth or give away the product for free. It's okay to hire a ton of folks and burn a lot of money in service of growth. And like you said, timelines are short and it's focused on moving as quickly as possible. A lot of startups have this valley of death, right? That's normal. You burn capital in service of growing the revenue line. What happens in the valley is, in this traditional unicorn chasing model, is you jack down the valley of death as far down as possible in service of growing revenue as quickly as possible. I use this alternate story or model, I call it the camel. Well, you know, why did I choose the camel? It's an animal that, you know, when times are good, can guzzle water faster than anything else and sprint across the desert. But when times are tough, it can survive in the harshest climates in the world. And I think that's the story of what's happening around the world, where startups that are building as camels are doing balanced growth. They are, one, charging for the value that they create and have sustainable unit economics from day one. Two, they're managing burn. And three, they're taking a long-term view. A story that I like that I feature in the book is the story of Grubhub. The reason I like it is I often think of on-demand delivery as a market that's heavily venture subsidized. This business started in Chicago, raised by Silicon Valley standards a paltry amount of money, I think about $80 million in venture. Compare that to DoorDash, you know, $1.5 billion. Grubhub is now a multi-billion dollar business. When I interviewed Mike Evans, the COO and one of the co-founders, he talked a lot about how they were sustainable and profitable at every single fundraise. And every fundraise was for a very specific purpose. It was to expand to a couple other cities or to do an acquisition or whatever. And so in their case, right, they really managed this burn curve. They still grew very fast. They still had the network effects that all startups aspire to, but they did it with this balanced growth approach. And actually in their case, I call this idea of ditches of death instead of valley of death. They actually modulated their growth at every round to be able to manage risk. I asked Mike, I said, why didn't you go a little faster? How do you think of that trade-off? He's like, look, like I could have gone faster, but I would have done it at meaningfully more risk. And in some ways, that's what I'm talking about, is how do you like get to the same objective of successful, enduring, great businesses, but doing it with less risk by managing the outcome a little bit more.
Do you think there's sort of a disconnect in how we think about what it is to build a strong company for the long term?
Yeah, I think that what's happened in the Valley is that in the particular ecosystem that's existed around, you know, software-based startups, an abundance of capital, and kind of this enamorment with this idea of blitzscaling, winner-takes-all markets, I think we've fundamentally misunderstood what it takes to scale most businesses. There are businesses that are truly winner-takes-all, and you need a lot of capital, and you need and highly competitive situations. I just think that's 1% of all venture-backed companies, which are really 1% of all startups, right? Like it's a really small minority. And for most businesses, I think we've got lost in this narrative of like, you need to do round after round after round, you need to scale as quickly as possible. And in some ways, you know, the idea of investing for sustainability, resilience, but also growth, like that's not a new concept. This is a little bit of what's old is new. But actually, I think that the best entrepreneurs that are doing it for this kind of model with tech and tech-enabled businesses are coming from outside the Valley. So in some ways, I think the pendulum has just swung way too far over the last decade in the Valley. And I think around the world, the pendulum has actually stayed a little bit more in the middle in this balanced approach.
I would love to just hear about where you see opportunity in the days ahead in these types of camel type businesses that you talk about. I wonder, heading forward, where there might be some opportunity for a smaller business to find a better trajectory that is building more robustly, that is building more confidently.
And I think that's such a pressing question. And obviously, we are in the eye of the storm. And in the storm, you know, the camel point is a question of survival and resilience and be able to weather some of these storms. I think there's that. And some companies are going to be more or less positioned based on how much capital they are and what sector they are. So I think that's kind of a question. But then there's the question, which I think is a more interesting one, of like what happens after. And here again, I'm optimistic. I think it's cheaper than ever before to start a business. I think things like Amazon Web Service or other business infrastructure like Shopify, you know, you can rent a server by the supercomputer by the hour instead of having to open a server farm. You can have a full e-commerce suite turned on automatically. So I think we're going to see more and more businesses getting built because it's easier, it's cheaper to do it. I also am optimistic that with VC, now people working on Zoom and doing that, I think we're going to see greater access of capital to entrepreneurs outside of the traditional centers. So I'm actually optimistic that coming out of the crisis, we're going to see a big resurgence of new business. And you know, I think there's some data points that suggest that some of the best businesses get built in some of the toughest times because we actually see those opportunities that come out of that.
I would be remiss to not ask you some advice with your venture capitalist hat on. I wonder for someone, you know, in the middle of building something now or thinking just about launching something and their mindset might be it's a tough time financially. There's no way anyone is going to want to back this venture. I wonder if there might be particular sectors that you are looking at.
So it's interesting. I professionally, you know, are fond, my work as generalist. I've been really interested in three sectors, which is financial services, healthcare, and future work personally. And I think the corona crisis doesn't change the opportunities that existed before. Like the problems that existed before around we need better financial inclusion, we need more affordable cost of healthcare delivery. We need to figure out ways to help retraining or find more efficient ways for people to find jobs or whatever. Like those challenges slash opportunities haven't changed. What has changed is that we have this acceleration point where, you know, Microsoft CEO yesterday said 2 years worth of digital adoption happened in the last 2 months. So there's this big acceleration towards digital adoption. I think some behavior change as well, that in many ways makes those opportunities more germane and perhaps more interesting today than ever. So I think for me, the kind of things that I'm interested in haven't changed. I think that the way they'll manifest themselves and the speed at which they'll manifest themselves perhaps has. And I think it's understanding how the behavior change and what is going to be enduring in that, I think is going to be pretty interesting to reflect on.
Alex, this has been fascinating. Thank you so much for your time.
Hey, this has been a lot of fun.
Alex Lazaro in San Francisco. His excellent new book is called Out Innovate: How Global Entrepreneurs from Delhi to Detroit Are Rewriting the Rules of Silicon Valley. My thanks to Alex and to Christy Evans, who mixed and edited this show. Don't forget to get your questions in for next week's expert panel, question@monocle.com. I'm Daniel Bache. Thank you so much for listening, and goodbye.